The English Eccentric by E.O. Higgins.
In 1765, a distinguished French scholar by the name of Pierre-Jean Grosley visited England for the first time and was struck by the level of eccentricity he observed in the natives. Writing home on the subject, he noted that this unusual behaviour he had observed could be attributed to a mixture of fogs, beef, and beer, aggravated by the tedium of the English Sunday. And he didn't even have to put up with the indignity of Mrs. Brown's boys. The father of utilitarianism, John Stuart Mill, once declared, "The amount of eccentricity in society has generally been proportional to the amount of genius, mental vigour, and moral courage which it contained. That so few now dare to be eccentric marks the chief danger of the time." But what is eccentricity? Eccentricity is that sort of behaviour in individuals that is considered odd, unusual, or quirky. It describes an often unintentional breaking away or dismissal of the social norms, to pursue avenues in life that are often considered beyond normal priorities. But there's always something fairly benign in the motives of the true eccentric. Otherwise, any old serial killer could make the list. The writer Edith Sitwell stated that many were called eccentrics because they're entirely unafraid of and uninfluenced by the opinions and vagaries of the crowd. The eccentrics we'll meet in this podcast series are often people with corkscrew minds, peculiar obsessions, and largely incomprehensible outlooks. They straddle the sexes and all social classes. Some of their stories are famous, but most are unjustifiably obscure. But hopefully, what they all are is worth a listen.
Colonel Charles Sibthorpe, 1783-1855. The Constant Conservative.
If the role of the Conservative MP is to maintain the status quo, then Colonel Charles Sibthorpe should be adopted as the party's poster boy. During a distinguished parliamentary career, Sibthorpe's voting record shows that he divined malevolent motives to every reform and opposed any kind of progress whatsoever. Sibthorpe enjoyed a childhood of considerable privilege. Mostly spent hunting in the verdant green countryside around his family's ancestral manse in Lincolnshire. And it was this, it seems, that instilled in him a permanent fixation on Englishness, regardless of the fact that his experience of it was almost entirely outside that of most English people. After schooling at Eton, Sibthorpe proceeded to Brasenose College, Oxford. But uninspired by his university lectures, he promptly threw over his studies and joined the army, serving first in the Royal Scots Greys before joining the Dragoon Guards to fight in the Peninsular War. Following the untimely death of his elder brother in 1822, Sibthorpe became the heir to the family estate, and mindful of his new duties, he retired from the army and returned home. Part of Sibthorpe's new way of life meant taking up the post of Lincoln's Tory MP, a position, it seems, that was basically under his family's control. As it turned out, this was a very good thing, because come polling day in 1826, as Sibthorpe stood to make a speech explaining the policies behind his candidature, he was immediately knocked unconscious by a brick hurled from the crowd. Oof! Despite this mild setback, he romped home. Taking up his seat in Parliament, Sibthorpe quickly established a reputation as the most conservative MP the House had ever known. He was keen to make a difference, albeit through the unusual expedient of demanding everything stayed exactly the same. The misery Sibthorpe felt at living through a period of political unrest characterised by radical reforms and social changes is palpable in his speeches. From his first day as an MP, Sibthorpe denounced any kind of innovation or reform as a fundamental attack on the English way of life. He sneered at even the mildest hint of change as humbug, and so predictable was he that he inspired considerable laughter from all sides of the house. Though his habit of doing a rooster impression every time his opponents made speeches was typically met with a somewhat cooler reception. Sibthorpe was set apart from his fellow MPs not only by his unusual aversion to progress, but also by his peculiar mode of dress. Shadowed by the brim of an outsized white top hat, Sibthorpe peered out imperiously from behind antique Quisling glasses, his pink, animated face finally resulting in a thin, feathery beard. He favoured a bottle green frock coat, wide breeches, and long jockey boots in the Regency style. His hot look naturally endeared him to political caricaturists of the period, and Sibthorpe frequently graced the pages of Punch, something that brought him to national attention. Early in his parliamentary career, Sibthorpe made a number of emphatic speeches in the House of Commons opposing the Catholic Emancipation Bill, a proposed reform that would allow followers of the Roman Church to live in the country without fear of persecution. He believed this was going too far. Somewhat predictably, Sibthorpe was very much of the opinion that the amount of persecution endured by Catholics in his childhood was, on balance, probably about the right amount. Despite his best efforts, the Catholic Emancipation Bill passed. However, Sibthorpe did have more success with another one of his campaigns. Even if it was to bring him into direct conflict with Queen Victoria herself, and herald an unprecedented royal boycott of Lincoln. Naturally, Sibthorpe was a dyed-in-the-wall monarchist, and indeed he had been honoured to fight for Queen and country. However, when Victoria made her forthcoming nuptials to Prince Albert of Saxe-Coburg-Saalfeld a matter of public record, this was problematic for him. Prince or no prince, Albert was from somewhere other than England, and to his mind, this made him a foreigner. On the eve of the royal marriage, a motion was presented to Parliament to allow Prince Albert an annual annuity of £50,000. Sibthorpe immediately opposed the motion, and in a typically thunderous speech to the House, suggested that £30,000 was more than enough for a foreign prince. Observing that many members of the government benches were visibly moved by Sibthorpe's condemnation of the Prince Consort's fundamental foreignness, Robert Peel, then leader of Her Majesty's opposition, sensed that it might be a good way of embarrassing the government. Unexpectedly, Peel decided to support Sibthorpe's amendment, and it was carried. The Queen was so incensed that from that day on, she refused to set foot in Lincoln ever again. Sibthorpe's suspicion of foreign types was to bring him into conflict with Prince Albert again in 1851, this time over his part in the organisation of the Great Exhibition. Sibthorpe was characteristically scathing of the whole idea, which he thought was designed to bring waves of base foreigners to England's shores.
"The immoral aliens are coming to rape English women, burgle English houses, spy on national defences, and undercut English traders with their cheap, shoddy foreign merchandise."
Accordingly, Sibthorpe described Crystal Palace itself as
"that palace of tomfoolery, that unwholesome castle of glass,"
and beseeched Parliament to pray to God to smash the humbug down
"with hailstones or lightning."
For reasons somewhat more obscure, Sibthorpe also took against the construction of London's National Gallery, despite the fact that by the time he got involved in arguing against its creation, the building was all but completed. Undeterred, Sibthorpe made impassioned speeches that it should be immediately pulled down again. Sibthorpe's attempts to maintain a tight hold on the England of his own childhood proved untenable, and soon it developed into an all-consuming belief that Britain was being brought to its knees by foreign types and their treacherous agents inside the government. The man behind the Catholic Emancipation Reform Bill, Lord John Russell, became one of Sibthorpe's bitterest enemies, and his progressive agenda inspired much public and parliamentary rancour from the Colonel. When Russell became the principal leader in the fight to get the Reform Act to pass through the House, which proposed sweeping changes to the electoral system by abolishing 56 rotten Tory boroughs and giving more commoners the vote, he became all-consumed with rage.
"I oppose the bill, the whole bill, and every part of the bill. I say it must go, and go to the devil. I believe it'll give political power and electoral franchise to the very dregs of the community."
Soon, Sibthorpe was scrutinising Lord Russell's every move. In 1835, when Russell was leader of the House for the Whigs and struggling to take his militia staff reduction bill through the House, Sibthorpe was appalled to see that one detail was a proposed reduction in the number of drum majors. That is, those individuals charged with leading a military band. As an ex-drum major himself, this was personal.
"The noble lord, having no ear for music, proposed one sweeping, and he would say, revolutionary measure to do away with all drum majors,"
protested Sibthorpe to the House.
"The noble lord is not aware, probably, never having been a drum major himself, that the office was one of the most difficult to fill up at a moment's warning, and that the course of training for drum majorship was both difficult and expensive."
It could have been an odd hill to die on, but it never came to pass. Despite all of the Colonel's bluster, Russell was comfortably able to bat off the strangely niche assault. And, in the ensuing 2 decades, went on to further infuriate Sibthorpe by becoming his beloved England's Prime Minister. Twice. One of the biggest upsets to Sibthorpe during his 30-year tenure as a Member of Parliament was, of course, the railway boom. Though he had initially dismissed trains as a
fanciful invention, which may be here today and gone tomorrow.
When they failed to be gone tomorrow, and for many successive tomorrows, Sibthorpe was forced to revise his opinion on the steam humbug. Indeed, it grew into something of an obsession for him in his later years in government, and he routinely opposed anything to do with the railways, which he denounced as a degrading form of transport. He became entirely convinced that trains would not only bring about wholesale slaughter of the British public, but also, somewhat more bafflingly, that they would be the catalyst of moral degeneracy. To back up his claims about the burgeoning train network, Sibthorpe pored over newspapers and journals, hunting for reports of railway accidents. And, clearly not finding as many as he'd like, he gave a series of increasingly exasperated speeches to the House, in which he declared that train deaths were being routinely hushed up by the railway companies, and that not one railway accident in 10 was brought to the public knowledge. Though, all things considered, how he'd arrived at these numbers wasn't altogether clear.
"I have long considered all railway public frauds and private robbery by gambling speculators,"
Sibthorpe intoned to an unshocked parliamentary audience.
"It is my decided opinion that these nefarious scoundrels will ere long appear before the public in their true light, and that all the railway companies will be bankrupt, and that the old happy mode of travelling on turnpike roads in chaises, carriages, and stages will be restored."
Whilst writing The Idiot in the late 1860s, Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky would regularly read parliamentary reports, and it is believed that Colonel Sibthorpe was the model for the character of Lebedev, who in the novel discusses the apocalypse in relation to the railway. Quoting the Book of Revelations, Lebedev portentously claims to have identified the star that is called Wormwood as the network of trains spreading across Europe. In Sibthorpe's final speech to Parliament in 1855, he accused his old adversary Lord Russell, who had just returned from an essential fact-finding mission to Vienna in the company of 32 male and female companions, of defrauding the public purse, with, it has to be said, some justification. Calling it an underhand and low bit of business, the elderly statesman jeered at the response from then Prime Minister Viscount Palmerston and withdrew from the House. During Christmas week that same year, Colonel Sibthorpe's death was reported in a number of newspapers across the country. The obituaries that followed were something of a mixed bag. Sibthorpe was described variously as the military chieftain that had no confidence in anything or anyone in the House of Commons, who hates the humbug of opposition heartily as he despises the gammon of government. To a man whose name has long been a household word as the embodiment of honest but unreasoning Tory prejudice. To simply Colonel Sibthorpe, that unbending and farcical representative of Toryism. Punch described Sibthorpe as unchanged and unchangeable as the Great Pyramid, and stated that the publication would have mourned human mutability if the Colonel could have changed. Let other weaker men yield to reason and common sense, but let our Colonel live and die invulnerable to their influence, close and shut up, as a crocodile is shut up in its scales. The journal also published a sketch of a monument they thought should be installed and on permanent display at the Crystal Palace. It was a statue of Sibthorpe, resplendent in his full military regalia, riding into battle upon the back of a mule.
Next on the English Eccentric.
The man who would not be king.